Republican Congressman Peter King of New York this morning defended that hearing he's holding tomorrow that's called The Extent of Radicalization in the American Muslim Community and that community's response. King told Good Morning America that he's put the focus on the Muslim community because that's where the greatest terrorism threat is. And he said two American Muslims will testify about how imams in their mosques told them not to cooperate with investigators. George Stephanopoulos asked him for more proof.
I can tell you from my experience, every law enforcement person I've spoken to in New York has told me they do not get the cooperation. I give examples.
Are they going to be testifying?
No, because I get so many witnesses, and I have the people on the ground that have these Muslim Americans who have themselves been victimized by their own community, to me, is much more effective.
King had previously said that he wasn't bringing forward witnesses because they didn't want to talk. Well, one law enforcement officer who's been invited to testify by the committee's top Democrat is Leroy Baca. He's sheriff of Los Angeles County. We read about him and Peter King's earlier claims in an article last month. Because, Sheriff Baca, you testified on this topic in the recent past, right?
Yes. Several months back, I was in for this very committee talking about how we in Los Angeles County, and that's in a county of 11 million people with close to 500,000 Muslims, how we outreach to the Muslim community and work with them in a variety of learning experiences, whether it's in the mosques or schools they have or in the festivities that they have.
Well, and what is your sense of whether or not Muslims cooperate?
Muslims do cooperate. You know, the real difficult part that all Americans are facing is how do we figure out a violent radical in what are the alternatives when we do figure out that someone is going in that direction? And it's remarkable that we've been able to do rather well. Of the last 10 terrorist attacks that have been thwarted, 8 of them involved Muslim people coming up and saying things that were important. I commend Secretary Napolitano for the See Something, Say Something program. And we here in Los Angeles are using that program along with an iWatch program so that suspicious activity does get reported when it occurs.
Well, what do you make of Mr. King's comments, again, the first time you testified, saying that he didn't expect to call any of the local law enforcement or counterintelligence experts who he maintains have told him repeatedly that non-cooperation by American Muslims is a, quote, significant issue. He says that these law enforcement people will only say these things privately, not in public. Are you hearing that?
No, I'm not hearing that myself. And I'm a member of the Major City Chiefs Association, the National Sheriff's Association, as well as the Major County Sheriff's Association's boards, and also with the International Association of Chiefs of Police. I think that we're all a little confounded by what becomes a radical plot with violence in mind, and so we have to rely on each other, and that's why we build public trust relationships with the Muslim society as we do with all the other societies. And the Middle East is highly represented in Los Angeles. We have a large Iranian population, a large Lebanese population, large Israeli population, along with Muslim populations, and not all Arabs are Muslims. Many of them are Christians. So this all becomes a part of a public trust model that we're using here in Los Angeles. And we believe that if there were some violent extremist activity being discussed or planned, that by trusting police, you'll more likely be having a willing person come forward and say, yeah, you know, it's not about me, it's about the problem.
Well, but let's try to get at what perhaps Mr. King is saying. We've quoted from the independent research group, the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security in North Carolina. They found that 48 of the 120 Muslims suspected in domestic terrorism plots since 9/11 were turned in by fellow Muslims. But you can turn that on its head and say that means that 70 weren't, you know?
Right.
And somebody would say, well, that's not good odds. Only 50 were turned in. Those other 70 must have known someone in the Muslim community, and they weren't turned in. I mean, can you see that reasoning?
I can see that reasoning, but I'd offer something that's more important than that, and that is that all violent individuals plan their violence in secret. And often the question that's not asked is those that were closest to these individuals in the 48 cases, how many people in their families even knew about it?
Well, and just give us some examples. You talk about having forged these relationships with Muslims in your community in Los Angeles. Can you, you know, as much as you can for security reasons, can you just tell us some of the things that might have happened? Is it parents who come forward with information? Is it members of a mosque? What kind of information do you get?
You know, most of these cases, you want to nip them in the bud, where a particular family had a member who was radically performing differently as a person than the family was accustomed to, and they called immediately into the authorities, and we were able to work with that family, and this matter was nipped in the bud. That's an example.
And are you talking about families suspecting that one of their children have been recruited or something? When you say nipped in the bud, like, as much as you can tell us, what kind of activity?
You know, I can't give you a full explanation of the activity because it's not smart to do that. What you really want is to know that it's happened. Huh. That's the question. I don't want to get into how they've cooperated. That is known by the authorities. Where I want to say is that we have a program to outreach to the Muslim society so that there can't be the excuse that no one was there to receive my information. No. That really is the whole purpose of see something, say something. It really means how receptive are the police in building relationships with the community that could conceivably have a violent person planning some kind of nefarious attack.
Well, I mentioned the Triangle Center report, finding that, you know, many Muslims did give tips to officials that led to people picking up people who might be terrorists. We understand that. I mean, it's almost comical, except it's not a serious subject. But in some communities, Muslim Americans were so concerned about this that they actually, in a couple of cases, turned in people who turned out to be undercover informants. Do you have undercover informants in the community?
No, the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department nor the Los Angeles Police Department, neither one have these operatives. But I don't disagree with the idea, though, that undercover officers could be necessary. So I don't think that we as a country can afford not to have various forms of ways of determining where violence is being planned. And if you have people like this Muslim American Homeland Security Congress that I helped form here with the Muslims, this is an educational arm. This is an outreach arm. So there's no excuse for any Muslim family to not contact another Muslim who then will know what to do with the information to the authorities. We're really not interested in dealing with the family as though they're suspect. We really want the family to cooperate to help solve a problem before it gets too big.
That's Leroy Baca, Sheriff of Los Angeles County, going to be testifying in Washington this week. Sheriff Baca, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
By the way, that report from the Triangle Research Center saying Muslims do cooperate with law enforcement. On Good Morning America this morning, Congressman Peter King called it skewed and misleading.
They include cases in there, for instance, such as the Zazi case in New York, the subway bomber. They give an imam credit for turning him in. Actually, the imam tipped him off, and the case was almost broken. They give credit to the vendor in Times Square who saw a car on fire, and he reported it, and that was the Times Square bomber. How did he know that involved in a terrorist attack?
Obviously, this will be part of the debate in tomorrow's hearing. But our next guest says there should be no debate over the need for looking into the radicalization of American Muslims. Jarrett Brackman, he runs the terrorism consulting firm Cronus Global LLC. He's also a professor at the University of North Dakota. And Jarrett, give us a sense of the amount of radicalization you see.
I think there is a growing number of mostly, you know, young Americans who are getting caught up in supporting extremist Islamist ideologies. Now, that doesn't mean that there's a lot of them, but it means that there are more than there had been. And trying to understand why that is kind of the goal right now of a lot of counterterrorism researchers.
Well, help us do that. We'll tick through some names. We know, of course, about Nidal Hassan, the Fort Hood shooter. There was Najibullah Zazi, the former airport shuttle driver who admitted to plotting the New York subway suicide bombings last year that failed. Faisal Shahzad, the Pakistani-American who attempted the Times Square bombing. But each of them came to their radicalization through a different path. I mean, we know Nidal Hassan had perhaps psychological problems, but he was also influenced by Anwar al-Awlaki, the Yemeni cleric. Is this one of the problems that there's not just one figure, there's not just one path to radicalization?
Well, that's right. We see different personality profiles, different political mindsets, experiences. Some of these guys go to Yemen. They have actual contact with real terrorists. Others are do-it-yourself types who are online and decide at some point that they're not satisfied with that. They think they've got to go to Somalia, fly somewhere to be a real jihadist as opposed to a cyber jihadist. So it's very difficult for us to say that, you know, we know what's causing this.
Well, tomorrow at the hearings, we're going to be hearing from a father, Melvin Bledsoe. His son is Carlos Bledsoe. He went to college here in Massachusetts, converted to Islam in college, but became radicalized in Yemen. So he had gone abroad and then came back, and now he's accused of shooting and killing that recruiter in Little Rock. So there's someone who went overseas and came back.
First of all, the attack that he did was not the one he had hoped to do. He had hoped to kill three rabbis in his area of Memphis. He had out-of-date information on where they lived, so he went to Plan B, which was to go find uniformed military officers and shoot them. When the news came out, a lot of people dismissed this as being just kind of a crazed psychopath. But he since has said, no, he did this in the name of Al-Qaeda. And so it's hard to understand what exactly triggered his path.
Well, but it's somewhat easier to trace others. You have Zach Chesser. Now, this is someone you met online because he was posting to your blog. And as you write in Foreign Policy magazine, he became your pen pal, the jihadist. And why do you think that he is so dangerous, somebody who uses the Internet quite a bit?
Well, it's always easier for us when these individuals go online and they kind of track their own path towards radicalization by posting, they uploading. And Zach Chesser was case in point of what an American kid who has too much time on his hand, who doesn't feel that he's gaining meaning and identity from conventional social activities. So he retreats online. He retreats to this extremist ideology. You know, Zach realized that he could be legendary on the Internet, even though he was kind of a, you know, what you could call a loser in the real world. And so by posting and by contributing, you know, he gained reputation and status. And I think what's going on here is, thanks to figures like the American Yemeni Sheikh Al-Laki, they're rewarding and incentivizing people for doing more online. It's become almost a game. You know, as Chesser posted more and got more status, reputation, he began to feel that he was the cyber equal of a real Al-Qaeda terrorist out there in Pakistan.
Right. Well, it also made him more visible, and so he has since been arrested. But you write that there are people doing this from jail.
That's right. And so by going to jail, these individuals don't stop their attempt to influence others and to gain that status and reputation. So either by writing notes that are they send out that are uploaded, or photos or drawings, they're still serving as a rallying flag for others. So going to prison has now become something that's actually cool and considered heroic within the American online jihadist community.
Well, so given this, Jared, I mean, you started off by saying here you are someone who studies terrorism in the United States, and you say there is the need to take a close look at it. Is Representative Peter King's committee in Congress going about it the right way?
Well, I think that's just it. There's two sides to this. One is the conversation must be held in a candid way, but also must be done in a way that doesn't further alienate Muslims in the United States. And I think there's a lot of concern that the way this has been unrolled with the King hearings, it's brought in more extremist positions. And the fact is, from my personal experience, I have found the Muslim American community to be incredibly engaged.
You mean engaged in helping officials
right.
Stop this? Yep.
You know, the Muslim American community realizes that when one of their own is arrested or tried on terrorism charges, it does all of them a big disservice. They're going to be over-policed and monitored and scrutinized. And it all plays into the problem is that Al-Qaeda's message is, we need to convince everyone that there's no difference between Muslims and terrorists. How do you blur the distinction between Islam and Al-Qaeda?
They want it blurred.
They want it blurred because it allows them to recruit easier. It allows Muslims in the United States to feel more alienated. And so I would be worried that the King hearings and some of the other things we're hearing about does more harm than good in trying to address this issue.
Jared Brackman, again, professor at North Dakota State University, and also he runs the terrorism consulting firm Cronus Global LLC. Just briefly, we talked about your pen pal, Zach Chesser, who's been arrested. Do you know, have you been in touch with him? Does he have any remorse, or is he more hardened in his thinking?
Well, we haven't been in touch. Zach and I were trying to plan a real-world debate right before he was arrested. And since then, our contact broke. His father submitted a letter to the court where he takes kind of a passing shot at counterterrorism analysts who he says have some blame in his son's radicalization, because by monitoring his postings, they actually goaded him into doing something more. Now, as one of those analysts, I think that's an outlandish statement. But, you know, there's a lot of emotion here. There's a lot of concern about these aren't aliens or monsters. These are real kids in our communities who are falling into this ideology. And I think we need to take a hard look at why that is.
Jarrett, thanks so much.